Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, go to our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 1st of July, 2026, and this is episode 386. On today's programme, I talk to three historians, Amy Fox, Mike Finch and David Morgan Owen, about their recent book on how people understood and interpreted the First World War at the time. They spoke to me from their respective places around the globe. Mike, Amy and Dave, welcome to the podcast. Now, to begin with, before we get into the questions, could you give us a bit of background about who you are and where you are? Because I know we are on many diverse points around the globe as we speak.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Tom, and thanks for inviting us on the podcast. So I'm Amy Fox. I'm a senior lecturer in the School of International Relations at the University of St Andrews. In terms of my research interests, some of your listeners may have been familiar with my first book, Learning to Fight, which is very much about a institutional examination of learning in the British Army in the First World War. And since then, I've been really interested in the relationship between individuals and military organisations, which hopefully I'll expand on a little bit more when we get into the meat of the podcast. But that's me.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having us. Thank you for all your wonderful work on the podcast. Big fan, long-term listener. My name is David Morgan Owen. I'm also a senior lecturer in the School of IR at St Andrews. So we're coming to you from Coastal Fife. I'm a historian primarily of the history of strategy and conflict, and I'm particularly interested in the kind of maritime aspects of the First World War and some of the process of strategy making that are connected to those.
And I'm last. Hi, Tom. My name's Mike Finch. I'm an associate professor of the history of war and strategy. I work for a university called Deakin University, which is a multi-campus university that's based in Victoria. But I actually live in Canberra, where I work for the Centre for Future Defence and National Security. And most of our day-to-day work involves working with the Australian Defence Force in professional military education. I've done various pieces of research work that relate to the history of military thought and strategy. In this forum, I would describe myself as First World War adjacent for the most part. I wrote a book about Gallieni and Leyte and colonial warfare before the First World War. And more recently, I wrote a book about some books called Makers of Modern Strategy.
I remember reading Parrott's version doing my MA 30 years ago. Anyway, despite that, giving away my age. Right, ladies and gentlemen, let us begin. So to begin with, what drew you to the idea of framing as a way to rethink the history of the Great War?
So I'll try and jump in first on offering an explanation for this. And I guess maybe it makes sense to take a little bit of a step back to think about what we were seeking to achieve when we set out on this project a number of years ago now. And I suppose a kind of crucial objective that we had was to try and bring into more fruitful and profitable conversation what we might think of as the military history of the First World War with some of the other flourishing areas of First World War studies that have benefited a lot from the kind of cultural turn in First World War history over the last 30 or 40 years. I think any time that you make broad claims about a scholarship and body of history as rich and diverse about the First World War, you do create some hostages to fortune. So, you know, I don't want to be too declarative in this, but I think that it's fair to observe that the military history of the war and the social and cultural history of the war do not always profitably cohabit in a lot of areas of scholarship, in the sense that there's wonderful work being done, but it's very often not necessarily speaking to the same kind of issues or debates. And indeed, some of those historians are not actually speaking all that much to one another. This was clarified really effectively in an essay on the cultural turn by John Horne that observed that the cultural turn essentially was conducted to a very great measure in a sort of semi-parallel universe to what he called causal history of the First World War. And what we were really seeking to do was to find a way of bringing these subjects together. So we thought to ourselves, what is a suitable vehicle or means to do this? And we kind of circled around ideas of perception, of thought, of experience before we kind of settled on the idea of framing as maybe being something that would be an analytical device that enabled us to bring these different sort of subjects together. I don't know if anyone might want to elaborate on any of that.
I think also in a very general sense, in various different ways and in collaboration with each other at certain points, we'd all become quite interested in the history of the field or the subfield of military history. So some of it also comes from that, and I think underlying some of the motivation is also a sense of, at times, trying to. At times becoming quite frustrated by the divisions that seem to exist b between different approaches, and then also becoming sometimes involved in critique, and then thinking, all right, well, critique is one thing, but can you put your money where your mouth is a bit? So in some senses, this book is an attempt by us to do something that responds to that clarion call that John Horne was sort of alluding to in his essay.
Just to add to that, I suppose from a why frame or why framing was useful, this does have a slightly longer history in terms of scholarship on the First World War. So some of your listeners might be familiar with Robert Gerwarth and Erez Meneller's notion of like the greater war. So thinking about moving away from just thinking about the First World War in terms of that 1914-18 bracketing and actually putting that in what Gerwarth and Meneller call sort of a longer and geographically more expansive frame and a very specific use of that word, which really spoke to us, but also in some of Priya Satya's work. So her scholarship very much trying to unframe the Western Front and then actually reframe the Middle East as speaking to ideas around empire, air policing that we see occurring in the interwar period. So what happens when we draw a different frame and what kind of comes together when we reframe things? What does that admit? What does that limit? And what are the opportunities? So I think from a conceptual aspect, that was an important underpinning to what we were trying to do.
So moving on, so 1914, expectations are defied. How did these initial misconceptions by political leaders and military planners affect the way that they interpreted and responded to the conflict as it unfolded in 14 and 15?
I think this is a really interesting subject that speaks to quite a lot of the broader themes that we were trying to get to in the book, because I think in 1914 you witness this kind of collision between many of the expectations and emergent realities, and how to respond to that is massively complex if you view that challenge solely through the prism of military expertise, strategy, technique, how to organize a military force. But it is also a challenge that has really profound and wide-ranging implications, be those emotional, personal, political, ideological, in all sorts of different ways. And this kind of speaks to what we hoped to achieve by mobilizing this idea of a frame, is to try and bring some of these wider range of issues that might connect to particular challenges that emerge as a result of the war together into a kind of single conversation. And I suppose you see people respond in quite a diversity of ways. You can almost see some people seeking to double down on existing forms of knowledge and ideas as a way of coping with the psychological challenge of what's being experienced. Just because something is difficult does not mean that it necessarily invalidates all of the things that I already think. That's a very natural human impulse, I think. But then you begin to see other people who are responding to the war and seeing it in terms of a need to generate new, fresh, diverse, different thinking. And to reconceptualize what war might actually mean. And I think a number of the chapters kind of speak to those processes playing out in different institutional, national, and imperial kind of contexts, which I think is really interesting and thought-provoking in a comparative kind of way.
Specific chapters here. Something I was really struck by, and thinking here of Van der Wilcox's chapter on Italy, sort of volte-face, is that it has to reorientate, right? Its force structure, some of its doctrine, from thinking about particular wars, thinking about fighting alongside particular allies, and then having to almost, undo a lot of that. So there's something really interesting here about preconceived notions, expectations, and structures, and how they have to be adapted and unraveled. But also thinking about some of the sort of previous conflicts that inform thinking as well. So particularly thinking of Bander's chapter here, how Italy's experience in Libya was largely kind of put to one side in favor of focusing on the lessons, and I put that in quotation marks, the lessons that came out of, say, the Russo-Japanese War or the South African War. So we can see how these almost experiential historical touch points still become almost increasingly relevant as armies are trying to find ways, as it were, to make sense of the conflict that is unfolding.
I suppose as well, like there may be a way in which some of this also it helps to get across a sense of the inevitability of selectivity in some of this stuff as well. That like I suppose this is a then as now thing. It's a curious thing when you see to that Italian example, an instance in which experiences that your nation wasn't involved in preferred to one that was. In order to guide you as to what you're going to do next, because it tells you a lot about what's being, again, it comes back to this question of what's being included and what's being excluded in the way that something is being framed, and that because you have temporal constraints going on as well, so decisions have to be made and choices have to be made, often quite definitively, quite quickly.
So one thing I liked about the book was its global reach. How did looking beyond the Western Front to the Ottoman Empire, Russia, India, and North Africa change your sense of how the war was understood?
This is a good question with relevance to the audience of a podcast with Western Front in the title. And I think this speaks to a kind of a number of issues that we've kind of trailed already in a sense, in that the historiography of the First World War has obviously come a tremendously long way over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And we're probably at an incredibly luxurious place now in the sense that fantastic new bodies of work exist, particularly in English for those that don't read multiple languages, on all sorts of aspects of the war that wouldn't have been accessible to previous historians. Nonetheless, however, if we think about this in terms of historical production, the density and sophistication of scholarship on particular issues is uneven across the war as a whole. So, for instance, there is such a depth and nuanced and incredibly detailed understanding of many aspects of what happens on the Western Front, but some of that is certainly in the Anglophone literature not yet evenly represented across other areas. Speaking as someone who focuses on the maritime aspects of the war, is very unevenly represented when we think about the war at sea as an example. So I suppose in trying to include a wider consideration of the many of the principal belligerents in the war, we really profited from the fact that there's been this profusion of scholarship, and some of the techniques that historians are increasingly using to indulge in and benefit from these kind of transnational comparisons, and being able to, even if you're not a deep expert on dynamics in another country, to be able to benefit from scholarship on it and think about reflexive comparisons in your own work has been tremendously important. I think that kind of spreading that lens wider opens up really how much profitable work there is still to do by being able to bring these other belligerents into the same analytical conversations that we've had about many of the kind of more established aspects of the historiography. So I think we could see this, for instance, in Alex Watson's chapter about learning in the Habsburg military. This is a subject that military innovation studies has very seldom, if ever, touched upon, because the Habsburg military is not frequently stood up as an exemplar of optimal military performance. Yet bringing it into the same kind of frame that exists in debates about learning in the British, French and German armies opens up some really valuable new vistas for understanding what might be going on, thinking about learning in and of itself, but also thinking about Habsburg military performance. And I think we can see the same thing in Sofia Anisimova's chapter on Franco-Russian information exchange. You know, we know a decent amount about kind of the movement of advisors, attachés, liaison officers between the French, the British and the Americans on the Western Front, but we know much less about how this might play out in some of those broader transnational kind of conflict.
Yeah, just to add to that, thinking about, again, these more specific chapters, like Snea Reddy's chapter on anti-colonial resistance as well, but also my own chapter in the collection on gossip, makes us think about who's, you know, to go back to, I think, Mike's point, who's included and excluded when we're writing these histories of the First World War. Because, you know, a lot of our focus in the book is on, you know, commanders, decision makers. But actually, what happens when we, again, widen that frame to include individuals who are part of resistance networks or military wives, for instance, who are largely seen as quite peripheral. And I think this is where some of the real utility and benefits are to bringing some of these cultural and social approaches into the same frame as military history, is that you get a far more nuanced but a much sort of wider range of actors, their motivations. And I think, you know, Snea's chapter in particular, not just in terms of its geographical spread, right, looking at anti-colonial resistance in North Africa and India, but who these individuals are, how they're interacting with the imperial metropole, is, you know, again, an example of that really kind of innovative scholarship that is inherently comparative in nature.
I think the other interesting thing is that if you think about it across the course of the book, there is an element of this where when we're talking about the imperial dimensions, it contributes in different ways that we've to some extent managed to grapple with, in terms of, you know, if you think about mine and Dave's chapter, where the imperial aspect is an important element of what we're trying to talk about from the perspective of imperial power, thinking about the concept of strategy itself. And then if you contrast it with something like Snea's chapter in particular, where, you know, the imperial dimension is a lens through which to try and understand completely oppositionary sort of perspectives on the parts of those resistance networks. So across the book as a whole, I think there is to some degree an attempt to try and capture a greater breadth and a greater multiplicity of meaning when it comes to things like imperialism and the imperial elements of what we're talking about.
So several of the chapters explore the military as a social space. And this is an area I was very interested in, because I'm looking at motivation and how that actually impacts learning, the learning process, and how important is it? I mean, again, another project to come amongst many other. So we look at the military as a social space, from gossip in the British Army to the medical views in Germany. Why was it important to put these cultural and social practices alongside strategy and operations?
Happy to have a go at this, only because it gives me a license to talk about gossip, which is my favourite thing to talk about. So I think this is again another area where the cultural and social aspects and the military aspects can really be brought together. And I think maybe, at least when I used to think about military commanders in the First World War, right, they are all very serious, black and white, mustachioed, you know, very, very happy to send, you know, battalions across the front line, and seem to do it in a very sort of uncaring way. But actually, I think certainly what came out of my chapter, but when applying some of those cultural approaches to matters of high command, we can actually just really see that emotions and affect cannot be quarantined from decision making. And there's some, you know, obviously very moving examples of this. So I'm thinking of Justin Bantalzo's work on Edmund Allenby and the death of his son impacting his pacifism in later life, for instance, is that without incorporating emotions and affect into decision making, you know, we're holding these individuals up into very unrealistic ideas of rationality, right? Like hyper rationality here. And so I think understanding the military as a social space, I think it adds a degree of, you know, realism fundamentally to our understanding of military organizations in particular. And it also, I think, helpfully problematizes them. Like who actually operates within a military organization? Where are we drawing the boundaries of these institutions? And, you know, Tom, as you know from your work on motivation, morale, etc., is that these things are invariably quite fuzzy. People's motivations, their sense of belonging, whether they're part of a military organization or part of society, these are not always, you know, incompatible identities as well. And so I think the aim here was to just problematize what can be quite hyper-rational, simplistic notions.
And I think this speaks to the broader object of the book and the value that we saw in this idea of framing, because fundamentally, strategy and operations can be seen as cultural and social practices, or ones that are heavily imbued by cultural and social assumptions of one kind or another. It would be impossible, for instance, to think about strategy in imperial context without being able to at least consider issues of race and how that may have shaped ideas around what strategically mattered and how you might pursue a particular strategy. In the same way, lots of quite wide-ranging ideas about society and politics are highly relevant to debates over strategy and operations. Like if you think about something like the management of labour or manpower in contemporary parlance, the idea that society as a whole should make particular sacrifices with a view to supporting the military in a particular way is a debate that is informed by military judgment, but can hardly be said to be solely the preserve of military judgment, because it speaks to a much wider set of ideas about how society and politics should be configured in support of a particular war effort, and indeed about what war itself actually entails and means. So I think by bringing some of these themes into communication, we're just trying to open up those complementary vistas that enable you to kind of see the multi-directional aspects of what's going on in some of these contexts.
Yeah, I suppose it, you know, touches on issues to do with like what are the constituent parts of knowledge, right? That I think when we're really trying to sort of grasp like what can we do with this kind of stuff, what does it kind of open up, that there's a sense in which, when this is where Amy's work is really strong with this kind of stuff, is like pushing towards breaking down some of those boundaries between this idea of categorizing things as cultural, social, strategy and operations as separate. I mean, obviously, like in practice, that's an extremely hard thing to do. But it does speak to, I suppose, that, you know, part of what we're doing with the book is to do with framing, and framing involves selectivity, and it involves some things that are exclusionary. But the whole way in which we sort of pitched the book at the very outset is like addressing stuff in terms of an ongoing seductive notion of trying to capture the totality of the war. So I think it's imbued with that kind of stuff as well.
The book also considers international law, blockade, and alliance strategy. How did the divergent national visions of international order complicate cooperation between allies?
So I think that the complications of making strategy or making war in the context of an alliance is a really rich theme of existing First World War historiography, right? People like Elizabeth Greenhouse, Burke, Bill Felpart have obviously made really important contributions to thinking about the war in terms of alliance, but also all of the complications that come alongside that. I suppose I think chapters in the book speak to this in a couple of ways. So I think firstly, Mike may wish to say more about this. The chapter that Mike and I authored about Anglo-French strategic thought before the war aimed to kind of challenge slightly the idea that it's helpful to think of strategy or indeed war primarily in national silos or exclusively in those terms. But more directly to speak to the points that you make about law, blockade, and alliances, I think this is a really fresh aspect of the scholarship on the war, where a lot of new thinking and ideas are particularly coming out at the moment. And we're really lucky to have contributions from Gabriella Fry and Louis Hailwood that speak powerfully to these themes. And I think what really emerges from that scholarship is the extent to which the war acts as a vehicle to generate new ideas about how the world could be ordered and about what role law and force might play in that process of reordering. And to a really considerable extent, those ideas grow out of the very complex, difficult, contested process of making alliance war in the context of a globalized economic system. So those kinds of forms of cooperation between Britain and France, Britain, France and Russia, Britain, France, Italy and Russia, and increasingly drawing on the resources of those relevant empires, negotiating with the United States, that is a really powerful catalyst, not just in terms of thinking, but also in terms of actually the bureaucratic, administrative aspects of being able to try and reconsider what it's possible to do in terms of making a new international system, a new international system in terms of how economics works, a new international system in terms of what the rules of the game might be, and how those might be enforced. And I think that both Gabriella and Louis are really important participants in a discussion about how blockade, or the idea of blockade in particular, becomes increasingly seen as a tool of a nascent international order in the 1920s and 1930s. This idea that the blockade was such a powerful means of coercion that it could actually be used in preference to a kind of global military police force in order to actually uphold international order. So I think in these chapters we see the ways in which the war really changes how people can see what a post-war world might look like, in all sorts of different ways, whether that's about new forms of military alliance and cooperation, bureaucratically, economically, administratively, and otherwise.
I think also that it kind of underlines some of the validity of taking the time to investigate and consecrate some of our time to thinking about the visions for things that did not come to pass, right? That actually there is certainly utility in doing so, even if, on face value, you might something or think of something, it's conjectural and it didn't happen, therefore it's unimportant. But even if they're treated historically, visions of where someone wants to get to in the future tell you a lot about where someone is at the point at which they're having those ideas. So there's an inherent utility in doing that, even if we know that, international order didn't necessarily pan out in the way that certain belligerents expected, and whatever curbs on Britain's power, for example, might have taken place as a consequence of the war itself. I don't know. I don't really know. I mean, on the imperial thing, I guess the only thing I would sort of build on with Dave's is to, I mean, obviously echo his sentiment. But it is interesting that that is one sphere in which I guess one of the things we were trying to get across was a little bit contrary to something oppositional, because, and there's some of this stems from other work that I've done, that there is a kind of beneath the national competitive aspect of pronouncements about imperialism, you often seem to see a kind of latent sentiment of similarity amongst imperialists, Western imperialists, in the sense that they feel that they are part of some kind of shared endeavor, and therefore that in some ways they are similar to each other.
And another theme, again, which I'm fascinated in, is the whole area of innovation and learning. Now, whether that's innovation in the Habsburg army, in the Russian trenches, or the US experience, what patterns of adaption or mislearning stand out across these very different military?
I would be delighted to speak about this particular topic. All of our chapters are fantastic, and really thought-provoking, but for me, the chapters in the innovation and learning section in particular, I think really maybe challenge some of the traditional historiography about who is a learning organization in the First World War. And we think about the historiography around, say, the British Army and the German Army, to a lesser extent, the French Army. That is where much of the literature is focused. And so having chapters on Russia, Austria-Hungary, Italy, and as you point out, the US, you know, these are not necessarily militaries that feature in our understanding of what is an effective learning organization, to use that management term there. I think what all of these chapters do is they speak to some of that important scholarship around the challenges around learning between theatres, but of course learning from allies and adversaries as well. And I think all of those chapters do that particularly well. What I would say is there's a couple of avenues to pull out here. Something I was really struck by was the different forms of knowledge and information that these militaries are drawing on. So Sophia's chapter in particular, she really highlights the importance of individuals. So who's heading up particular military missions, who's a particular attaché, and the role and the power that individuals can have in deciding, say, which French pamphlets are going to be translated, for instance. You obviously have the formal side of things as well, so the exchange of doctrine. These are topics, these are subjects that are very, very familiar to those of us who work on learning in the British and German Army. So it's quite interesting, I think, to see how that works out in other national case studies. But what I would highlight is that we also see similar challenges. And something that really came through for me in these chapters was what we might call the stickiness of experience and knowledge, or the highly context-specific nature of this. And we can see this playing out organizationally, but also geographically. And I think this is where Sophia's chapter is really strong, is how relevant is drawing expertise and insight from the Western Front to apply that to a very different geographical and tactical environment on the Eastern Front. So what needs to be mediated there for that to make sense? And I think this ties in finally to, you know, something that's quite common in international relations is notions of prestige. So what happens if you are the Habsburg army and you're adopting German stormtroop tactics? What does that mean for you? Does that mean that you're, whether we talk about ways of war or particular tactical development, does that render it insufficient? In the same way that Sophia's chapter speaks about a lot of the tension around what will that mean for Russian military prestige and prowess if that military is wholesale importing French best practice. So there's a lot of kind of mediation at play there. And I think that in very, very short, I suppose, response speaks to the real kind of granularity and insight that these chapters offer on what is a very fraught and complicated phenomenon.
I think it's just to build on that, it's interesting seeing the ways in which this kind of selection of case studies speak to some of the key themes related to military learning, right? Because in many ways, many of the militaries that would not necessarily be singled out as potentially being widely regarded as the most effective or the most successful are nonetheless quite capable of seeing quite clearly things that they would like to change, learn, do differently from their vantage point. I think this comes through in Vander's chapter, but also from Alex and Brian as well. You know, the case of the Americans, it's not really a case that they were unable to perceive what the nature of the challenge might be, and that they were ignorant as to how they might need to change their force structures, training, doctrine, approach in order to meet it. It's that those realizations occur simultaneous to all sorts of really profound barriers, blockages, constraints, difficulties that make it very difficult to move from where you are to where you may actually wish to be. And I think that opens up some interesting kind of consequential questions about what is it we actually mean when we're talking about military learning. Are we having a debate about the relative ability of armed forces of one kind or another to perceive accurately the character of the war that they are engaged in, or are we having a discussion that is more rooted in a consideration of what we judge to be effectiveness, and how are we determining that and the relationship between the two?
So collaboration between established historians and famous historians and emerging voices was central to your project. What fresh perspectives or methods did that mix bring to the table?
I suppose, like, first of all, it's to some extent, it's just good practice, I think. There is also a sense in which, given the contours of what we were trying to do, trying to get as broad a range of people involved in addressing the problem set was just the best way to go about it. And what better way could you have than, you know, we're very fortunate that we have Sir Hugh doing the final chapter for us. And then we have right at the other end of the spectrum people who are at the very beginning of their careers as well. But I suppose also part of what it allows us to do is that if we sort of track back to the beginning and the way that we were talking about how John Horne's piece about the cultural turn in the First World War had provided a lot of the inspiration for this, and that some of what is being written in there is to do with the amount of work that still needs to be done to bring the cultural and the military aspects of the war, of studying the war together. One of the best places to turn in that respect is to people like Sophia and to Snea, because they are the ones who are, you know, if they're not that far away from the completion of their PhD studies, then they should be right at the cutting edge of what we're doing methodologically and responding to exactly the kind of things that we're trying to drive towards.
Yeah, I think just to echo that, I mean, we've already kind of trailed that it's almost never been a better time to be a First World War historian. Even though the centenary is over, you know, there's been such an incredible flourishing of scholarship that there've never been more resources available to people to be able to study the First World War. And as a result of that, you know, there are just some fantastically capable, able and innovative researchers that have grown out of that process and are able to benefit from work that's been done over the past number of decades. You know, I think that particularly some of the transnational dimensions that are brought out in Gabriella's chapter, but also by Sophia and Snea, particularly the kind of trans-imperial angle that bears a lot of comparison to kind of like Tim Harper's work on underground Asia, for instance. They're bringing new approaches and methods to bear, and they're also filling in gaps in understanding that simply just have not, questions that despite all of the work done have not really been addressed, and they're addressing them in new ways. So, you know, there's a huge amount of incredible scholarship coming from I hesitate to use the word like junior, because I don't mean it in a pejorative sense, but new scholars in the field are really taking it in really exciting and diverse directions. So I think that the First World War studies is in a very rude state of health. By the same token, we were really, really pleased that we benefited from the input of people who have played an important role in shaping how the discipline has evolved. You know, Mike's already mentioned Hugh's chapter, and I guess that's a really good encapsulation, I guess, of some of the other inspiration that we drew from the volume, in the sense that, you know, Hugh's work on strategy in the First World War has absolutely blended the kind of interest simultaneously in how people thought about particular issues and the relationship between thought and action. That is something that we've really tried to pull through the remainder of the book. So I think the combination has been even better than we'd hoped when we started out on the project.
So my penultimate question is, so stepping back, what does the focus on framing tell us about the relationship between imagined warfare and the lived reality of the battlefield?
So I think this is an area where there could be a tremendous amount of additional work to do, right? Because you know, one of the key contributions of the cultural turn has been its interest and emphasis on history from below, upon the day-to-day experiences of normal people in the First World War and what that can tell us. Now, in this book, we have focused explicitly and self-consciously on more senior elite perspectives, which is a traditional challenge of what John Hall refers to as causal history, right? If you're interested in cause and effect, you tend to try and study the people that were involved in those kind of key decisions. But I think there's a huge vista that could be opened up into the kind of ways in which normal soldiers, sailors, people conceptualized, conjectured about the war. You know, might use the word conjecture earlier, and I think some of those frames that they opened up into what the war could actually be are incredibly compelling and interesting. So I think here about some of Catriona Pennell's work on rumor and some of the almost sort of extraordinary rumors about things that could sweep through newspapers and the press and be regarded as you know, subjects of tantalizing, dare I say, gossip and conversation, open up really, really valuable windows into how people were experiencing and thinking about the war themselves. And I guess speaking to the concerns that we're engaged with in the volume, I think something that I've been continually interested in is the extent and the variety of the ways in which people did imagine the First World War, even as they were participating in it. And I think it helps to remind us that that no part of history is overdetermined, and that there's always a considerable amount of contingency and possibility that is perpetually at the forefront of people's minds. The enemy might do this, the weather might do that, how might my action unfold? And bearing that uncertainty in mind, I think, is a really, really important thing for historians to do when they're studying the war. Even if we are very familiar with what actually happened, that doesn't mean that people at the time were, and I think that's an important thing to bear in mind.
Yeah, and I think doing it this way really it really forces us in quite a palpable way to engage with the history in a sequence that allows us to appreciate how history is actually lived, perhaps a bit more than when, you know, if the starting point is what happened, what was the result, what went right, what worked, what didn't. It can lead us to a very sort of different vista and a different set of questions than when we think about us in terms of why did what happened vary from what was envisaged. And actually, to some extent, like I mean, obviously range quite widely in this, but some of it seems to me sometimes to speak to things that you can ally to understandings of war that draw from things, even from things like Clausewitz's On War, and talking about the way, you know, trying to get a more visceral appreciation of the ways in which war escapes control. You know, the way in which that dictum of everything in war being simple, but the simplest thing is hard to do, is something that, you know, you think, oh, that sounds like that's a really sort of wise thing to say. But some of this helps to try and sort of explicate and flesh out and give broader contours to a lot of those ideas.
And finally, the question I like to ask historians is, why does this history matter today? What can studying the First World War through the lens of frames teach us about military organisations and societies and how they make sense of war in their own time, or our own time, I should say?
I mean, to be honest, like a lot of the reasons are the same reasons that we've discussed across the entire piece, right? That there are, I mean, obviously, we're all historians, so we know that the past is different from the present. But there are also ways in which there are vast similarities that you see, and when you're trying to observe the way that military institutions try to grapple with problems in the present day, and that you know, all the time around us, when visions of war are being, or visions of future conflict are being articulated, you often get a sense of kind of the selectivity of those visions and the ways in which particular choices are being made about what is applicable and what isn't applicable, what's a transferable experience, you know, whether things that happen in Ukraine have any bearing on a potential Taiwan scenario. So some of this, again, it comes back to this issue of forcing a kind of a heightened granularity on, okay, well, what do we actually do with that? And we're trying to look in a bit more detail at this. Are there things that you can take from being a bit more cognizant of the way that these sort of processes of framing as selectivity and framing as exclusionary, as well as framing as aids to understanding and conceptualization, actually occur?
I would also sort of chime in that, I mean, our collective backgrounds is that, before we Mike went to Canberra and then Dave and I ended up in Fife, is that we all one time or another worked at, the Joint Services Command and Staff College. So our experience is working, quite intimately with military professionals and the institutions that they're part of. And without wanting to speak for Mike and Dave, something that really struck me as a historian of a military organization and someone who worked in a modern one is how such institutions are inherently social institutions. They are human institutions. That hasn't changed, and that comes with all sorts of, foibles and challenges, agenda, emotions, etc. And so how individuals try and make sense of things, how they feel about things, these to me are timeless, and I think range beyond just national silos, but internationally as well. So things like gossip, for instance, how do you find out about your next commanding officer? Well, you kind of, talk to the person who might have served under them, and you hear all the good, the bad, and the ugly. This is the lubricant that makes these organizations work. And whether you are, a subaltern in, the British Army or the German Army of the First World War, whether you are, a junior officer today, like those commonalities, I think, endure across time and space.
I suppose one final question is, where can people get this from?
Well, you can get it at all good booksellers. Actually, I don't know about that. You can get it on Amazon, absolutely. And you can get it direct from the publisher as well. It's worth keeping an eye out for flash sales and promo codes, because Kansas are very good at doing those kind of things as well. I'm not sure where else can you.
I think going direct to the Kansas page is a good place to start to support university presses or your local bookshop. And we should also take this opportunity to thank everyone at Kansas for their support during the project. Bill Allison, as series editor, did a huge amount to make this possible, as did Joyce Harrison, Andrea Laws, and others at Kansas. And we really appreciate all of the help and support that they gave all of our authors and us as editors.
So on that bombshell, I'm going to say thank you all three for your time this morning or this evening or this afternoon, wherever you are on the globe, and go out and get the book. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Tom.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.